Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. In this hour, we meet Colleen Fuller and Alan Castles, prescription drug consumer advocates and co-founders of PharmaWatch, an advocacy group for people experiencing adverse reactions to prescription drugs.
Colleen Fuller is an independent health researcher. She's a research associate with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, and she's the author of Caring for Profit: How Corporations Are Taking Over Canada's Healthcare System. Colleen Fuller is speaking to us from her home in Vancouver. Hello, Colleen.
Hi.
Hi. So what rights do consumers have, or should they have, consumers of prescription medicine?
Well, those are two really different things, the rights that they have and the rights that they should have. They're quite different. From the regulatory or the approval process to the post-market, once the drugs are approved and on the market, consumers need to take a more active role in monitoring those drugs and also in the pricing of prescription medicine in Canada. Consumers don't really have any role except through the normal process, electing an MP who might raise the issues in the House of Commons, or if they're fortunate enough to be appointed to an advisory committee that may be involved in some way in the regulatory process. But consumers do not have a voice or a role, generally speaking, in what is happening with prescription drugs, both before and after they're on the market.
What has been your experience as a consumer?
There were two reasons I became interested in prescription drugs. One is because, you know, my background is in health policy and privatization, and I do a lot of research in those two areas. And the prescription drug industry has had an enormous influence over all of the types of policies that we are affected by as Canadians. For example, the reduced stays in hospital are in part a consequence of the push by the drug industry to replace hands-on therapy, nursing care and physician care and so on, with drug therapy, because they claim that it's cheaper to take medicine than to have somebody actually touching your body. And because this, you know, had repercussions right through the healthcare system, including the amount of funding that hospitals got to provide care, it's not the only thing that influenced that, but it was one of the factors that influenced those types of policies. So, of course, I was interested in that.
Are you talking about the concept of disease management, where patients are less in hospitals and more just take medicines at home?
Exactly. The pharmaceutical industry in the late 80s and early 90s began to try to ensure that their part of the healthcare dollar was at a minimum maintained, but ideally increased. So they were getting 9% or 9 cents of every dollar. They wanted that to increase, and in fact it has increased now to about 15 or 16 cents of every dollar. So they say disease management, that this is something that they've designed to help patients have better lives, but actually it's designed to make sure that their hands are in your pocket for as long as possible and for as much as they can manage to take out. And these things are part of the disease management movement, if you want to call it that, what involved the pharmaceutical industry increasing its involvement in public policy that governs healthcare and the way healthcare is administered, the way the healthcare dollar is designated, and all of those types of things. This is a huge part of disease management, if you understand what I mean. The other part of disease management involves managing the approval and post-market system. So what the drug industry wants is they want the movement from the lab to the market to be as short as possible, because to them, all of those things that happen between the lab and the market is wasted time. It's time that they're not making a profit. That's part of their big, big thrust, is to make sure that drugs get onto the market as quickly as possible. And in some cases, that's a good thing. For example, with HIV/AIDS drugs, it's important for those drugs to get onto the market as soon as possible because people are dying and they need the medicine. And ironically, in some countries, the pharmaceutical industry is making it more difficult for patients to get those types of drugs. But generally, we want those drugs to be on the market quickly. With other drugs, though, people's lives aren't dependent on the drugs getting onto the market all that quickly. And so we can take more time to look at these more and more complicated drugs to see what both the short-term and long-term effects are. And I think that consumers need to pay more attention to that because people don't pay attention to it. And they need to be more involved in a formal way, not informally, but formally. Unfortunately, governments are not helping consumers become involved in some of this part of the process.
In terms of before the drug is on the market and after the drug is on the market, is there any difference in Canadian drug evaluation policy or protection of the consumer? Is there any involvement on the part of Health Canada?
Well, Health Canada does have laws that govern, for example, clinical trials, how clinical trials are conducted in Canada, and regulations also require that companies that want a drug approved in Canada have to demonstrate that the clinical trials that were done outside of the country meet the standards that have been established in Canada. And most people probably would say that the approval process is more stringent in Canada than it is in many other countries. And I think that may be generally true. Mm-hmm. It's harder to get a drug on the market in Canada.
It would seem that Canadian law is set up to support the agenda of the pharmaceutical industry. The role of patents, the industry's relationship with the government, and their ability to influence research, and their control of the market.
All of those things are true. The pharmaceutical industry wanted patents extended, and they got the patents extended. They wanted the approval for drugs. They have to go through a process to get a drug approved and used in clinical trials, and they got that reduced to, I think it's 30 days now. That's the time that the government takes to look at the drug and decide whether it's a safe drug and should be used in clinical trials. That was incredibly reduced, and the drug industry wanted that, and they got it. The drug industry also puts pressure to expedite the approval process so that drugs get onto the market sooner, and they influence the government's policies in that direction as well. The drug industry wants to be able to have access to patients so that they can enlist patients in trials. They develop relationships with the medical community so that the medical community, you know, is on the front lines of recruiting patients to participate in clinical trials. All of these things have occurred because of the power and influence of the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. Without consumers even being aware that these changes have been made, all that consumers know is that they may be taking a bad drug. They may be having adverse side effects to a drug. One of their children or a parent or a spouse may be having a bad reaction to a drug. That's what the end of all of that process can lead to.
Of course, individuals who are experiencing side effects, people with chronic conditions, they tend to blame the condition itself, and they tend to have faith in their doctors.
And that's exactly why people need to be involved in what is called post-market surveillance. That's the way that it's referred to. And what that means is that when a drug is approved, this is what is supposed to happen in theory. The drug is approved, consumers start to use it, and if there are unexpected or unanticipated effects, then those consumers go to their doctor and they tell their doctor, and then the doctor reports it to Health Canada. Or they may phone the company that made the drug and tell the company that this is happening, and then the company reports it, or the pharmacist or somebody else. Well, that doesn't happen. Then the reports that Health Canada receives, it's estimated that those reports represent about 1 to 3% of the actual experience once those drugs are on the market. So you can imagine how pathetic it is. It isn't working. One of the ways that the post-market surveillance system would work better is if consumers were encouraged to report, because they're the ones who know if they're feeling badly when they take a drug. So that's one of the things that has to happen.
So who would encourage them? Would their doctors encourage them? Would the doctors tend to encourage them to report any side effects?
No, I don't think that you can depend on the medical community for that. It's up to the government to encourage consumers to report. And one of the other big problems that we have in Canada, and this is another strategy, if you want to call it a disease management strategy, the drug industry has developed very tight relationships, not just with the medical community, but also with what are sometimes called disease organizations or disease groups. The Canadian Diabetes Association, the Arthritis Society, And these groups get money from the drug industry, and then they turn around and tell the public that they're independent because they don't get any money from government. But people with chronic conditions and other disabilities, they have to have public money to be able to organize and effectively advocate on behalf of their constituents. They have a right to have money to advocate on behalf of other people who share their chronic condition. You know, it's terrible that people have to depend on organizations that are funded by the pharmaceutical industry, and supposedly these groups are acting in their interests. So it's important for consumers not only to be able to report adverse effects to drugs, but they also have to have public money so that they can organize and advocate on behalf of themselves. This is really important.
So you're saying that's the most important issue, is public money in order to raise questions over the safety of a given drug?
That's right, and I think that people have a right to public money to do that. People need an organized voice to speak.
So Health Canada does not function as an advocate for the rights of patients or of...
No. Health Canada's job is to make sure that the environment for the pharmaceutical industry is positive, and to balance that with their responsibilities to protect public health. And that's how they would define their role.
On the question of adverse effects, so you're saying very little gets reported. Health Canada plays no role. People have to go to other agencies. What other agencies do you recommend?
Well, PharmaWatch was set up to encourage people to report adverse drug effects. We just were set up last year, so we're still in the process of getting our feet on the ground, so to speak. But one of the things that we are hoping to do is to get some public money. There's a number of things that we want to do. One is to encourage people to report to us what problems they may be having with prescription drugs. We will play a role of putting those people in touch with others or organizations who are involved in advocating for people with that condition or other people who have had adverse reactions to those drugs that they're reporting on. One of the terrible things about people who have adverse drug reactions is that they often don't know that they're having an adverse drug reaction. They feel that the problem that they're experiencing is their condition, if they're ill or if they have a chronic condition. They will say, well, this is happening to me because I have diabetes or because I have asthma or I have some other condition. So people need to be educated about what are the possible side effects of drugs. And if you can even imagine that information is held by Health Canada. There's a product monograph for every single prescription drug on the market. And if you want to get a copy of the product monograph, which is what outlines the drug, all the information, important information about the drug, the possible side effects to the drug, et cetera, you have to go through a Freedom of Information request to Health Canada to get this information. And so what we want to do is to publicize this type of information, make sure that people understand what the possible side effects are of drugs, and also to educate the public about what are the responsibilities of the pharmaceutical industry in terms of reporting adverse drug reactions, what are the experiences of people in other countries to the drug that people may be concerned about, because a lot of times a drug is being pulled from Europe, but it's still on the market in Canada, and Canada is much slower to respond to reported adverse effects.
You're saying that the restrictions are very stringent in terms of getting a drug tested and getting it on the market, but not after it's on the market.
That's right. It's harder in Canada, or it used to be harder in Canada, to get a drug on the market. It is very difficult to get it off the market. So if you look at the track record of prescription drugs in the last 25 years, there's a very high number of drugs that have been pulled from the market once they were approved. And the number of drugs that are being pulled from the market is increasing. So it's the post-market area that is increasingly important for public oversight, and that's what PharmaWatch wants to do. We want to increase public oversight of the pharmaceutical market of approved drugs so that consumers understand what types of adverse side effects have already been reported. If consumers are beginning to experience bad effects from drugs, we want to be able to alert the public, because a lot of times in clinical trials, the types of effects or side effects of drugs may not have been detected because the clinical trial period is too short.
When people suffer from chronic conditions, there's a certain undermining of people's health just from a psychological point of view. If you're taking a medication, the doctor thinks it's all right and the company is telling him it's all right or her, then you have to be doubly psychologically strong to go outside of this
doctor-drug industry relationship.
Yeah.
I'm a person who has experienced an adverse drug reaction, and I'm probably not atypical. I'm probably pretty much representative example of somebody who has experienced a bad effect from a drug. The drug that I'm talking about is synthetic insulin, and what happened to me was I began using synthetic insulin, which was the first genetically engineered drug to be on the market, and the testing, the clinical trials that surround this product are worrisome in my view. So I had a bad reaction to the drug, and it lasted for 5 years because I couldn't get any help. I didn't know if I was having a bad reaction to the drug or if something else was going on, and I also didn't know, in this case, what I could do about it. If I didn't like this insulin, it was the only insulin that was on the market. So what was I supposed to do, stop taking it? Well, that, you know, is a death sentence. So I continued to take it, and then I found out that there was another type of insulin available that I could take, and that didn't cause these bad side effects. So part of the experience for me, and I think that this is very common, is that I was completely isolated. The doctor didn't help me. The doctor didn't tell me that other people were having these problems. The Canadian Diabetes Association didn't tell me that this was a common problem or that other people may have been having the same experiences.
Why wouldn't they tell you that? Well, didn't they know it, or were they keeping it from you?
I have no idea.
They're not advocates for synthetic insulin, are they, the Canadian Diabetic Association?
No, I don't think that I would say that they're advocates for any particular type of insulin, but they are funded by the drug industry, and I think that that influences the energy that they put into some of these issues. This is something that they've been criticized about before, and I'm one of the people, in fact, that has criticized them, and not just the Canadian Diabetes Association, but other groups as well. For example, the Arthritis Society is no different. These groups that get money from the drug industry will not criticize the drug industry or the drugs because it endangers their source of income. Anybody who's involved in the healthcare sector that gets money from anybody, it doesn't matter whether it's government or from the private sector, you know that you have to
toe the ideological line.
Well, you have to be careful if you're going to, even if you're getting public funding, you do have to be careful if you're going to criticize the government if that's the only source of revenue. That is the way it is, and the disease groups get money from the drug industry and not from their members. So there was no support from the Canadian Diabetes Association. There was no information from the government of Canada. The companies themselves were basically sympathetic, or they pretended that they were sympathetic, but they don't care. What they care about is that you're still buying their products. So people end up seeing, because their doctors don't help them, they get referred to a psychiatrist, you know, they get this, they get take other drugs. You know, all of these things happen to people because the source of their problem is one drug, or it may be one drug, or it may be an interaction between one drug and another drug. But of all of the reasons why people may be having an adverse drug reaction, a lot of times the drug is at the bottom of the list of things that they would look at. They look at their chronic disease or their illness or their disability first. They look at something that they must be doing wrong. They're not taking the drug right. They're not eating properly. They should get more exercise. They're too emotional, you know, anything. They have psychological or psychiatric problems. People will look at everything else except the drug. And that's certainly what I was doing and what a lot of other people who are using synthetic insulin do. They're doing something wrong. It is their problem. They're the screw-up. they need to get their act together.
So PharmaWatch.
PharmaWatch was set up by myself and another fellow in Victoria by the name of Alan Castles. We set it up for several reasons. One is to help people break out of this type of isolation. This type of isolation exacerbates the bad effects of the drugs, and so people need to be plugged into knowledge about what's going on, and so that was one reason. The other reason that we formed PharmaWatch is basically to keep an eye on the pharmaceutical industry, to keep an eye on what's going on domestically and internationally with prescription drugs, so that, for example, if there are reports of adverse effects to a drug like Remicade, which is an arthritis drug, and these are being reported in the United States or in Europe, we can start to keep an eye on what's going on in Canada and to alert people in Canada to what's happening with that type of a drug. The third thing is to report adverse effects to Health Canada. Consumers are able to report adverse drug effects to the government now. This was not the case before, but in the last couple of years, they've set up a toll-free line, actually, for consumers to report. But most consumers don't know about that, and so we want to become more publicly known so that people will contact us with problems that they're having, and we can convey that information to Health Canada and also represent the interests of those people to try to push Health Canada in the direction that they need to go in.
Mm-hmm. Does PharmaWatch have a website?
Not yet. Well, we just really were set up, so we're applying for some funding to do a pilot project on two areas. One is anti-diabetes drugs, insulin as well as oral medications, and the other is in the area of antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs. Of course, this is another huge, huge area where people suffer side effects that are unknown, undetected. Nobody cares. As long as the people are buying the drugs, it's fine. I would encourage people to contact Health Canada, and their toll-free number is 1-866-234-2345. 1-866-234-2345. And you'll talk to a health professional or a nurse, most likely. When you report an adverse drug reaction, you don't have to have evidence that the drug is responsible for the reaction that you're having. You just have to suspect that the drug is linked to the reaction that you're having. So you don't have to provide doctors' testimonies that this is the reason that you're having these reactions. You just have to suspect that there's a link. We think about prescription medicine and the amount of money that we spend on drugs, and that's really important. I think that we spend way too much, and we should be pushing for price controls. But we also have to start looking more critically at the safety of drugs that are on the market. We expose ourselves to prescription drugs, and we take a leap of faith when we do that. We believe that if the drug is on the market, it must be safe. Otherwise, why would it be on the market? But we can't take that for granted. We have to become more involved in the process before drugs get on the market, and we certainly have to become more actively involved once drugs are approved and out there being sold and bought and taken. We have to pay attention to what happens to us when we're taking the drugs, what happens to our children, what happens to our parents, what happens to our partners. We just have to be more vigilant.
We've been speaking with independent health researcher Colleen Fuller in Vancouver. Thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
If you are experiencing adverse reactions to a prescription drug or would like to network with other prescription drug consumers, contact the following email address, pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net. Again, that's pharmawatch@pharmawatch.net.
I would encourage people to contact Health Canada, and their toll-free number is 1-866-234-2345. 1-866-234-2345.
Colleen Fuller's book, Caring for Profit, How Corporations Are Taking Over Canada's Healthcare System, is available through the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. Their website is at www.policyalternatives.ca. Again, that's www.policyalternatives.ca.
Granny's hooked on over and threw up. Georgie's hooked on Halcyon. Who knows what else he's on? Georgie, you should have listened to Nancy.
Just say no.
Georgie's no junkie. If you ask me, just say no. No, no. No, 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 no. No, no. Georgie's no junkie. If you ask Barbara, she just say no. No! Bert's hooked on Halcyon. Who knows what Lonnie's on? We found out listening to headline news. He was taking 50 a day. Bert's hooked on Halcyon. Who knows what Lonnie's on? Bert, you gotta learn to just say no. Bert's no junkie. If you ask him,
Castles is a pharmaceutical policy analyst, and he's also co-chairman of PharmaWatch, which is a prescription drug consumer advocacy group. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
True or false, 10,000 Canadians die every year from using prescription drugs?
That number has been quoted based on extrapolation of data from the U.S., which said 100,000 Americans die every year of adverse reactions from prescription drugs.
So, extrapolating from the U.S. is not the most reliable one.
Perhaps not the most reliable. The bottom line is that our ability to track and basically do surveillance on adverse reactions to drugs is appalling. It's quite bad. When I say our, I don't mean just Canada, but I mean the industrialized world. We have lots of very high-tech systems and bureaucracies to get people to use drugs, but we have very almost inadequate systems to actually track and monitor the adverse effects of drugs. So it could be 10,000, it could be 50,000, it could be 20,000. We don't know. That's the bottom line. We don't really know.
So what access do consumers have to information on medications that they're being asked to take?
Typically, consumers get printouts from a pharmacy, which might list the side effects and warning information about a drug. If they get that, you know, when they've examined those computer printouts, they have found them to be be almost totally inadequate to really inform people about the risks and the benefits of drugs as well. They actually act as marketing pieces, really. The information is typically provided by third-party kind of information vendors, and when they've examined it, the information is not as useful as it could be. Maybe I should just talk about some of the research that I've done on consumer drug information.
Okay.
Part of the problem, of course, is that there are very few independent sources of drug information for physicians and consumers. Much of what physicians learn comes from the hands of the pharmaceutical industry, which has a business imperative to sell drugs. So a lot of the education that physicians get about drugs comes through detail people that visit their offices or through continuing medical education, which is sponsored usually by drug companies. And anyone who's actually looked at the medical school curriculum, anyone who's looked at it sort of objectively, has said, how well are we preparing physicians to be good prescribers? And almost everyone comes up with the same answer. We're preparing them in an almost totally inadequate way. They might get one or two classes in pharmacology, and most of the rest of their education comes from the pharmaceutical industry. It's part of the context that I guess PharmaWatch has been set up to deal with. The bigger context where you've got physicians prescribing drugs that haven't really been exposed to the objective, unbiased assessment of those drugs. And then you get consumers who are exposed to direct-to-consumer advertising and other sort of biased sources of drug information. It's no wonder that, you've got a problem in terms of overuse and inappropriate use of drugs. One of the major problems that I found in my research is the incredible misleading use of statistics to exaggerate the benefits of drugs. Let me give you an example. A drug which is designed to reduce the risk of osteoporosis, and osteoporosis is a disease involving the frailty of bones, which increases with age. It's more predominant in women. And so there's a drug that is being promoted as producing a 50% reduction in hip fractures in women. That's astounding. 50%, that sounds wonderful. Well, when you actually look at the study, and if you actually take the time to read the study, you say, well, how many women actually had hip fractures? And in the normal population, this is a four-year study, 2% of women had hip fractures over a four-year period. And these are considered high-risk women. These are women that have had previous fractures, and they have considered to have low bone density.
This medication for osteoporosis.
Yeah.
It is claimed that women who take this medication won't fracture their hip.
What the marketing of the drug says is that it will reduce the risk of hip fractures by 50%. But when you look at the study, the number of women who had hip fractures in the study who were on placebo, there were only 2% of the women had hip fractures. The women who took the drug, an equal number, 1% had hip fractures. So the company's not lying. It is a 50% reduction. But overall, it went from a 2% reduction down to a 1% or a 50% drop. Half of 2% is 1%. So if they tell you we're reducing your risk of this disease by 50%, what you have to know is what is your risk in the first place.
You gave another interesting example having to do with the drug Evista, which claims to reduce incidence of breast cancer by 76%.
Yeah, exactly. And when you looked at that study, well, what was the incidence of breast cancer in those women in the first place? Well, it was 1%. And the women who took the drug, their risk was 0.24%. So yes, the company's right. It's a 76% reduction, but it's a 0.76 reduction.
It's 76% of 1%.
Yeah. So that's the benefit of the drug. Then you have to compare, what are the risks of the drug? In the Evista example that you gave, the women who took the drug compared to those who took placebo had a 3 times greater rate of venous thrombosis, blood clots to the legs or lungs. So it's still a very small percent. I think it was in the vicinity of 0.03% or something like that. Very small. But if you use the same relative percentages, a 76% reduction in the risk of something, compare it to what is the risk of the side effects. Well, in this case, it's a 300% increase in the risk of venous thrombosis. So it's that kind of misleading use of statistics which bamboozles a lot of physicians and also bamboozles a lot of consumers into believing that drugs have a much higher benefit than they actually have.
And this is, of course, particularly difficult in the case of people who have conditions like heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, and arthritis, because they're dependent on the assessments of their doctors.
That's right.
Socks and kick off your shoes. We got news. Pick up the beat and move out your feet. Have we got news? Pull up your socks and kick off your shoes. We got news. Pick up the beat and move out your feet. Have we got news? Say, I'm having a hot flash. I'm making a mad dash. I'm picking up more gigs. Headaches, no more hot dates, the menopausal jig. Woo! Pull out the horn and shout new morn. We got news. Put on a smile and create a style. Have we got news? Pull out the horn and shout new morn. We got news, yeah. Put on a smile and create a style. We got news. Having a hot flash, making a mad dash, picking up more gigs. I'm having a headache, no more hot days, it's a menopausal jig. Woo!
You were interested in speaking about another area having to do with two arthritis drugs, Vioxx and Celebrex.
Yeah, here's another example of, we call it bias in the study of pharmaceuticals. We've got a brand new drug to treat arthritis, which has been studied over 12 months, another which has been studied over 15 months, and then you read the study in a big American journal, and they present the data at 6 months. So if they did the study over a year, why would they only present the data as 6 months? Well, the drug is being promoted as being safer on your stomach. By the way, you should know that the class of arthritis drugs I'm talking about are called NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, include everything from acetaminophen up to Celebrex or Vioxx, the most expensive, newest drugs to treat arthritis. And one of the major side effects of these drugs are the harm caused to the stomach, perforations, ulcers, and bleeding to the stomach caused by these arthritis drugs. And they estimate about 3,000 Canadians a year die from gastrointestinal complications due to their arthritis drugs.
I saw on the web, on the Vioxx website, it says you can click here to contact an attorney. Vioxx is a 4-time risk of heart attacks, evidently. Heart attacks, stroke,
yeah.
Kidney failure. Celebrex has a great risk of ulcers and stroke as well.
Yeah, and of course, this information was never communicated to people in a meaningful way for them to make informed decisions. And that's the point that I'm making about the consumer being naked in the pharmaceutical marketplace. Mm-hmm. So these drugs are being promoted as being safer on your stomach when the study was 12 months or 15 months long. Why would they only present the data at us at the six-month point? Well, that's the point at which the drug looked most impressive. So there was a difference in the number of patients that had endoscopically proven ulcers. So they could see that the patients who are taking the COX-2 inhibitors had a slightly reduced rate of ulcers at 6 months. Well, was there a difference after a year? Because arthritis patients don't take drugs just for 6 months. And after a year, they found, well, there was no difference. But that information was never communicated to people as well.
So what do we learn from this example in terms of unbiased assessments, especially for people who have arthritis, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease?
For the consumer, let me just speak in a sort of general context. The access to unbiased and objective drug information is vital for people to protect their health, their own health. And if the physician and the consumer aren't being told the full goods on the nature of these drugs, then there's some serious public health considerations. The situation with Vioxx and Celebrex, for example, billions of dollars were spent on advertising those drugs, and those drugs were absolute blockbusters, the biggest drugs to hit the market ever.
Very successful. That's just
extremely successful, but at what cost? Did it actually reduce the rate of ulcers and complications for the general population.
Is it possible?
Well, no. Yeah. What it probably did is increase the rate of cardiovascular risk.
Is it possible that these medications are actually too strong? I mean, too strong even for the arthritis problems that they're intended to correct?
No, it's just that for any medication, it can deal with one problem, but it causes others. You know, a drug that has an effect also has a side effect. Very powerful drugs that have very powerful effects also have very powerful side effects. An example is a drug called Bacol, a cholesterol-lowering drug. It was just pulled off the market in about the last 6 months or so in Canada and the U.S. This is a drug which very powerfully reduced your cholesterol levels, but at the same time, it caused rhabdomyolysis, which is a fatal muscle weakening. And there were over 100 deaths in the U.S. attributed to that drug. And you know, we have other drugs that are in the same class as this drug that was pulled off the market, perhaps not quite so potent, so they might have actually a reduced rate of adverse effects and side effects. But there would still be possibilities that the other drugs that lower cholesterol can have these same effects.
These doctors who are in their offices prescribing, perhaps over-prescribing, plus they listen to people who come around trying to sell them products, drug company representatives?
Probably the best doctors are those who don't see drug reps, those who actually would take that time to read the independent drug bulletins. You know, they have a group in the U.S. called, which was started by an internist in New York City, a group called No Free Lunch, and they have a website. I think it's www.nofreelunch.org. And they have pledged to not accept pharmaceutical company freebies and not to allow the influence of the drug industry to affect their prescribing. So they take this thing called the pledge, and you can go to their website and sign up on their pledge, and the doctors get these little buttons, declare themselves drug industry free, and you know, say no to drug reps and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's starting to become part of the consciousness of medical culture that the pharmaceutical companies do have a lot of influence, and the greater that influence is, probably the less appropriate care patients are getting.
I'm wondering if there is such a thing as prescription culture in the sense that patients are dependent on getting a prescription in order to feel better.
Yes. Yep. There is a prescription culture. In fact, something like, this is an older study, something like two-thirds of office visits end in prescriptions. And in Canada, anyways, when you've got medical visits, office visits that last on average 7 to 8 minutes, where the doctor is supposed to figure out what your problem is, diagnose what you have, and then prescribe a drug or a test or whatever, more often than not, you're going to leave the office with a drug, partly because the doctor might not have had the time to actually explain all the other non-drug things that you could be doing to treat your condition. I mean, a good example is drugs for heartburn. You know, there are a couple of billion-dollar blockbuster drugs treating heartburn. If the doctors actually said to people, you know, eating a huge meal at 9 o'clock at night and then going to bed is the cause of your problem, the physician wouldn't have to prescribe a drug, and then the patient wouldn't be exposed to, you know, the side effects of the drug and the long-term effects of drugs, many which we don't know about because they don't test drugs over long periods of time.
The kinds of ailments that have been medicalized, people are receiving information or propaganda, you could say, from the media telling them that hormone replacement therapy, cholesterol problems, smoking, erectile dysfunction,
yeah,
obesity, male pattern baldness.
How about drugs for generalized anxiety disorder or social anxiety disorder? I'm not trying to downplay the seriousness of someone who has severe anxiety, but the way the drugs are marketed, it makes it sound like everyone should be on them. Do you often feel nervous in a crowd? You know, do you get sweaty palms and feel uncomfortable speaking in front of a group? Well, who doesn't? So what they're doing is they're taking a condition which might affect a very few number of people, and then they're just exploding it so that everyone who reads these ads or exposed to these ads say, hey, you know, I've got that. Maybe that drug's going to help me.
There was an article recently in April of this year by Moynihan and the British Medical Journal talking about disease-mongering to healthy people. So that, as Joel Ekshin says, basically the drug industry is out to make money. And so if they can sell you drug for the rest of your life and keep you on it, it's perfectly all right with them. And your body is paying the price.
Yes. You know, we used to deal with many problems in a variety of other ways. Depression, for example, we would deal with talking things out and other coping strategies. But now more and more we're turning to, you know, pharmaceutical cures, pharmaceutical treatments.
I think a lot of these are interpretable as people taking the drug instead of changing their behavior.
Yeah, part of that has been the definition of the disease. I mean, osteoporosis, for example, is a classic example of disease mongering because just because you have low bone density does not mean that you're going to fall and fracture. In fact, a lot of people who fall and fracture bones when they're elderly have normal bone density. So taking the density of your bones and creating a condition around it so that you can market a pharmaceutical, to me, would be okay if the drug actually did provide a significant benefit for strengthening your bones. But, you know, the drugs that are out there don't really do very much, and they do have some serious, potentially serious side effects. The example that I gave you about the drug that reduced the risk of fractures by 50%, that drug had the most serious adverse reactions reported of any drug in the U.S. in 1996. There were more than 6,000 reports made to the U.S. FDA around the drug, because it was so caustic, if you didn't take it properly, it would get caught in your throat and it could burn a hole in your esophagus. For a 1% benefit, for a 1% risk reduction in hip fractures, you have a drug that has more than 6,000 reports of adverse reactions in the U.S. And as I said at the beginning, we have a very poor post-marketing surveillance system. We don't know if those 6,000 reports is 1%, 10%, 15%, we don't know. There was a former head of the U.S. FDA who said that he believes that their agency was catching about 1% of the adverse drug reaction reports. They were catching about 1% of adverse drug reactions. So if you get one report, that's possible that there are actually 100 instances of adverse drug reaction.
That was where?
That was the U.S. FDA, a former head of the FDA in the U.S. Just the point being, if you've got a drug that the federal regulator has collected, say, 150 reports of deaths due to that drug, we don't know. Does that represent 1%, 10% of the deaths? Because a lot of the deaths aren't reported. Most doctors have never filled out an adverse drug reaction report. And this is part of the reason why we would go to the trouble of setting up PharmaWatch, is that health professionals don't report adverse drug reactions. They don't notice them. It's cumbersome. There are many reasons why adverse drug reactions aren't reported. But if those that are reported only represent 1% of the actual numbers of people who are being harmed by the drug, in the case of that osteoporosis drug I mentioned, that could mean that, you know, anywhere between 6,000 and 600,000 people could have been injured by that drug.
So adverse drug reactions, an essential thrust of the PharmaWatch campaign.
We believe that the consumer has to become intimately involved in monitoring the reactions of the drugs they take. Because the health professionals aren't doing it, the regulatory bodies aren't really doing it, they're kind of doing it, but they can only rely on the reports they get from the companies and from doctors who report adverse drug reactions. If you had a system where consumers were making reports on reactions that they were experiencing, that is an incredibly rich source of data that you could share with the rest of the population. So, you know, the instance of new drugs coming onto the market, if you have no way to track what the impact of that drug is on the general population, then you're never really going to know how many people are being injured or hurt by the drug. But if you had a system where consumers were reporting and actively monitoring the impact of that drug on themselves, reporting it to an agency, you could very quickly collect data that could inform the entire population.
So PharmaWatch wants to play a very unique role, now one having to do with unbiased assessments of drugs, another having to do with adverse drug reactions, sort of collating the information and analyzing the results.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that's probably the big piece that's missing from the whole picture about drugs, is the evidence of drugs' impact. Sure, you've got blockbuster drugs being launched all the time, and lots of marketing and lots of physicians prescribing these drugs and lots of people taking them. But what you don't know is you don't know the follow-up. You don't know what is actually happening to the people who are taking these drugs. You know, if you've got drugs that are being tested in trials that are 2 or 3 years long, well, what happens when the person takes a drug longer? I mean, an example might be cholesterol-lowering drugs where, you know, I have friends of mine, you know, 38 years old, being told by their doctors, you've got high cholesterol, you should be on a cholesterol-lowering drug. And I say, what for? Well, you know, I've got high cholesterol.
Well, can't they stop eating, you know, high-fat cheese or something?
Well, no, I mean, my point is, first of all, they have never tested the use of cholesterol-lowering drugs in people your age. And how long does your doctor expect you to be taking these drugs? Well, the rest of my life, they say. And I say, well, that's absurd, because they've never tested a cholesterol-lowering drug for the rest of your life. They've tested it in 5-year trials and shown marginal. When I say marginal, we're talking in the range of 1 or 2 or 3% reduction in mortality due to heart attacks. But what is the long-term effects? I mean, these drugs, which, you know, they go to the trouble of testing them in laboratory animals, and they find that these animals develop tumors and cancers. Well, is that something that you want to take the risk of in the long term?
Aren't there other approaches, though? There are other approaches to lowering cholesterol.
Exactly. You know, if you really want to reduce your cardiovascular risk, you should take your cholesterol-lowering drug and take it for a 5-mile walk every day.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's good evidence around that, too. Let me give you an example. My mother had a heart attack 2 years ago, right? And she gets out of the hospital, and her doctor prescribes her a cholesterol-lowering drug. And I say, well, Mom, do you have high cholesterol? She says, no. Well, okay. You know, there is some benefit of this drug. It's about in the range of 1 or 2%. So people like yourself who have already had a heart attack, over 5 years, 1 or 2% of those people would be prevented from having a second heart attack. So that's the benefit of the drug. Is it worth taking? It might be $60, $70 a month. Is it worth taking over the long term? And what other things can you do? And I said, well, if the drug gives you a 1 or 2% benefit, what other benefits are there? Well, if you took a 2-mile walk every day, you'd probably get a 20% benefit. If you quit smoking, which, you know, ironically she didn't, you would probably have a 30% benefit compared to a 1 or 2% benefit from the drug. So, you know, people have to know that though the drugs have benefits, compared to a lot of the lifestyle and sort of self-care things that you could do, they're not even in the same league. You know, I think the consciousness of people is being raised on this issue around lifestyle and that kind of thing. And a lot of people are starting to realize that essentially being more active is probably the best thing they could do, you know, to improve their health and eating better. But what people don't know is that the drugs that they could be taking to do the same things have such a marginal effect compared to the lifestyle things they could do.
Alan Castle's article, Understanding Drug Information, How to Read Between the Lines, is available on the Health Action International website at www.hiweb.org. That's www.hiweb.org.
Once again, if you are experiencing adverse reactions to a prescription drug or would like to network with other prescription drug consumers, contact the following email address: PharmaWatch@PharmaWatch.net. Again, that's PharmaWatch@PharmaWatch.net. And socially conscious doctors and medical students who want to declare themselves independent of drug industry influence can try the No Free Lunch website at www.nofreelunch.org. Again, that's www.nofreelunch.org. Next week, Farmed and Dangerous speaks with Barbara Mintzes of the Center for Health Services and Policy Research at the University of British Columbia. She'll talk about the impact on human health of direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription medicines. In the second half, Ellen Reynolds of DES Action Canada brings us up to date on the ongoing cross-generational health effects of a hormone drug that was banned in Canada in the early 1970s. Our sincere thanks to Colleen Fuller and Alan Castles.
Farmed and Dangerous is produced by the Community News Collective at CKUT Radio McGill as part of its award-winning long-term memory radio series. Our thanks to all of those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. Stay tuned for Long-Term Memory Radio each and every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on Real Audio on the World Wide Web at www.ckut.ca. This 10-part Farmed and Dangerous series is available in a set of CDs from Radio McGill. For more information, please give us a call at area code 514-398-6788 or visit our website at www.ckut.ca and click on Community News. This is Long-Term Memory Radio.